know, normally before we hit record, I would have asked you what you like to be called, but I did not. And so let's begin with that. What do you like to be called?
Andy's good. Yeah, Andy's good.
We'll rock with Andy. What's going on, man? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, I mean, jokingly, I think I have my autofill on those charts as like the Kale Lord or something.
You have it as the Kale Lord, and that was my first impression of you.
Like, you know what? I'm not going to change that. I did a few Calendly meetings like that, but yeah, all good, dude. I'm happy to be here.
There's quite literally a picture of Kale behind your head, so this is not a coincidence.
Most important thing you need to know about me, or top three, is that I've eaten raw kale 90% of the days of the last decade, for sure.
That's awesome. So, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's genuine right there.
Let's throw a couple softball pitches. That's sexist. That's not good.
Underhand.
Softball, dude. Underhand pitching is super hard, man. I did like a fast pitch softball lead, crazy hard. So underhand pitching being easy, that's not that. I disagree with that. But let's start with a warm up, which is, who are you and what are you passionate about?
Yeah. Who am I? It's a great question. I mean, professionally, you know, I'm a registered dietitian. I have been for the last 10 years working in private practice. Love writing, love social media. And for me, I love combining sharing information broadly and like whatever reward I get from that with working people one-on-one and seeing their own like personalized journey. So professionally, that's what gets me going. Personally, outside of nutrition, I love soccer. So that's like the other, probably soccer, nutrition, talking about those two subject matters. Very adept. We veer away from those, my competence is going to start decreasing.
What is your soccer fanhood look like?
I play and I watch a good amount of games, generally when I'm eating dinner at night.
What do you watch? What league are you watching?
I'll watch any good soccer, any good football. I'll watch, yeah, I mean, I'm open Champions League, Turkish league, Italian league, English league. I'm just a fan. I don't have a team like I die for or anything like that. I'm just a fan of the game.
That's awesome. I my wife and I both play. I'm a big Arsenal fan, big soccer fan. So yeah, we're down bad.
Yeah,
today.
I've been to the Emirates.
Oh, that's amazing.
I've been to the Emirates.
That's great. Yeah. Sweet.
For people who don't know, it's the Arsenal stadium. You people who listen to probably don't know by now, but yeah, a tough result of the weekend.
I'm
but
down.
That's okay.
I'm down bad. Yeah,
it's a long season.
Yeah.
I'm passionate about sharing cool stuff about nutrition that, you know, hopefully makes it easy for people to improve their quality of life. You know, I mean, on the most basic level.
Yeah, you do it extremely well. I said to you right before we hit record that you're one of my favorite people I follow on social media right now. Recently, in the last like 6 months or so, I started following you. And that's like, I don't know, I'm a smidge jaded a bit, you know, my love for social media, not doing it and not interacting with my community. I absolutely love interacting with my people. My wife asked me the other day, she's like, what are things that you like stress about? And I was like, almost all of my stresses come from social media, but not because I don't like making content, not because I don't like doing Q&As and answering questions and interacting with my community. I love all that. It's the game a bit. So I found myself just taking a small step back from my own feed. But anyway, you are somebody who I quite enjoy when you pop up. So yeah, you're doing an awesome job.
Likewise. I mean, goes without saying, likewise. The game has changed. I've been, you know, the game has changed over the last 10 years. So that's to say the least. It's interesting out there. So I definitely resonate with what you're saying, to put it mildly.
Yeah. What is something you've changed your mind or updated your opinion on in the last 5 to 10 years?
Well, I mean, change my mind, update my opinion on, I would say I've gone back and forth around let's tofu, let's call this the instinctual response. So what do I mean by this? Okay, so I out of the gates, new on social media, and I've loved tofu personally consistently over the last 10 years. Okay, out of the gates, I'm big on soy. Let's bust the myths. Everybody eats soy. I think, you know, health benefits, don't be afraid, doesn't do any of the bad things people say. And then I talked to more and more people, more and more clients, and I kind of, you know, was jaded, I guess is the word. I'm like, you know what, people aren't really down to eat this, whatever, fine. Like, I'm going to stop pushing it that much. If someone doesn't want to eat tofu, cool. I don't want them to think, you know, I'm weird or whatever. So I'm going to push it less. And then I had a conversation with a Akash Patel, who's also on social. I think you may know
he's going to be on the podcast soon, actually. I love Akash. Yeah. Good dude. Great
Perfect.
Dude. Yeah.
Perfect. Amazing. So I had a conversation with him in Florida. We met up in person. And, you know, he's a vegan.
Yep.
And he, you know, he's a very compelling individual, as you know, which is why he's going to be on your podcast. And I realized speaking with him, like, okay, wait a minute, you know, it's not as if I don't know the importance of protein diversity and plant protein and the ethical environment. I know these things, but when you have a compelling character, you know, reinforcing this, I'm like, you know, wait a minute, like maybe I do need to actually be a bit more firm in my stance on plant protein. And again, we're here to talk about beans, plant, you know, a source of plant protein. So it's not as if it's not a true answer to your question that I've drastically changed my view, but the relative importance of the topic and how I present it to people I work with has oscillated, let's say, for those reasons. So
there was a really good tofu pun that you had in there that you said you had to be extra firm on plant protein. So it was a good tofu pun in there. It's funny that you mentioned that because I don't even know. Are you a vegan?
I'm not a vegan.
Okay.
Closest I've been is pescatarian for several years.
So I was on another podcast. That's so cringe. You're on a podcast talking about you being on another podcast. It's super cringe. But I feel like I owe for years of not being as up to date on plant protein research and so been gently moving towards more plant-based diet and always ate enough fruits and vegetables, but probably from a protein perspective was just like, okay, I'm just going to do this animal proteins. And over the last two to four years have been slowly shifting that, just like the relative intake of animal protein and plant protein in my diet. The one thing that I keep getting a hiccup on is the inclusion of tofu. And I feel like if I could get to that point, I could go vegan. If I could get to like not just liking tofu, because I like tofu, but just some of the preparation. Yeah. If I could, because I think that there's, and we'll talk, I'm probably going to talk about this with Akesha a bit more, of like, that's a hurdle for me where it's like giving up that last bit of animal protein is a convenience thing. And I think if you can, listen, you don't need to like tofu to be vegan because you, we could talk about all the reasons why you just don't need to do that. But that to me feels like I really want to get it there. Maybe mm-hmm. because there's some subconscious feeling of like it would feel like meat. I don't know why I'm hung up on that a little bit, but I have yet to get to a point where I can conveniently prepare it in a way I really enjoy. So I see mm-hmm. where you had mentioned that. You said, hey, I'm big on this. And then I'm interacting with people who they're struggling with implementing this. And so I've taken a small step back. And so is that something that you were seeing with people that you're like, hey, they don't like it or they're not preparing it well? Or why did you kind of take a step back from that?
Yeah, there's resistance to it where I will tell my clients that I think diversity and protein intake is a valuable pursuit, right? And look, there's a large number of people who in the short to medium term, like they're not really going to be candidates to be going vegan. So it's not about that. We're not making any sort of value judgment here. We're just saying, hey, listen, like if you can diversify your protein intake a bit, it's realistically going to be a net benefit to your health, whatever that might mean to you in different ways it can mean. Yeah, I think I was just getting enough people who just didn't want to hear it in regards to tofu. I mean, tofu is, it is that way from the plant protein to get a massive amount, you know what I mean? And the likelihood is that if someone, and this is anecdotal, you know, 10 years of experience anecdotal, if someone doesn't like tofu, I mean, are they really then going to be sold on, you know, a vegan meat alternative? Probably not. Are they going to be, for different reasons, right? And again, anecdotal, tempeh, probably not. So I feel like tofu has a lot of potential for the right person. And don't get me wrong, I work with people who like tofu. It's just, yeah, I just answered your question really instinctually, and that's what came to mind. So yeah. it's very interesting. It's very interesting stuff.
Yeah, agreed. What is a nutrition hill that you would die on?
Okay. Well, diversity and protein intake. I would say that the majority of people would benefit, because this is what we're talking about today, the majority of people would benefit by including more beans in their diet. I think that's something that I feel very comfortable saying. But I would also give you a nutrition mound beside that, where I'll say as someone's diet quality goes up, the importance of beans goes down. Okay. So I'll offer you a duality there. For the quote unquote average person who's just like needs all the help they can get, I think beans are probably the single most valuable food if I had to pick one. But equally, their value goes down the more confident you are in your nutrition. And we can explore that for sure. But again, I'm going to give you that as my instinctual response.
Is that just because the value of any single food would go down as overall quality goes up?
Interesting. Let's look from this perspective. What beans offer? Large amount of fiber. So inevitably, you know, if we use like same criteria, as diet quality goes up in other areas, we're more likely to hit our fiber target. Many people don't. So that's one. The other aspect of it is beans are like very positively influential on our gut bacteria, cholesterol, blood sugar, blood pressure potentially as well, like the most common reasons people get medicated. So again, those are lesser concerns as we feel more confident. But for example, salmon and other fatty fish are the only sources, like really, of the omega-3s, EPA and DHA, and then primarily vitamin D, although it's added to some other stuff. So you can't make the same argument there, because if you don't eat fatty fish, you have to supplement those things, sure, or you have no chance to get enough. So you're absolutely right. It's a very fair counterpoint, but beans are a little bit different, I guess, than, let's say, salmon. So that would be like,
less,
that's what
less,
I would say to that.
Less of, it's not that they're giving you a single thing you can't get elsewhere. It's that they are so powerful in so many ways that sure, if your overall diet quality is really good, that you might be checking those boxes that you, but none of this discounts our section that will come later today, which is called ode to legumes, because you're right, they're just incredibly powerful, and that's been some of my favorite content from you, is some of the research behind that. So let's talk about fatty liver. That's mm-hmm. We'll call that our main topic today.
Sure.
Explain it in plain English for me.
Yeah. So fatty liver disease, essentially what it means is that very small amounts of fat are getting stored in your liver when they're not supposed to be. That, in the most basic terms, right? Generally, that happens. Big reason why it happens is insulin resistance. You know, big reason insulin resistance happens around diet quality, physical inactivity, right? There's other things play a role, right? Like, for those who don't know, like, after blood goes to your digestive system, it goes to your liver next. So the state of your gut microbiome is very, very important in dictating liver health. Which is why, you know, yet another reason why beans are really important, because they help to facilitate the growth of like healthy bacteria. So that would be a very simple answer to that question.
You've called it, in several pieces of content, a silent epidemic. Why have you given it that name?
Well, the only way to know that you have fat in your liver, being stored in your liver, really is via ultrasound, or what they call FibroScan, which is essentially like a similar ultrasound imaging. And there's not really any symptom. Like, the most common symptom of fatty liver is fatigue, which is such a broad general thing. Okay. So that's basically the main reason. There's no overt signs. You may be more likely to be diagnosed with a related condition first, like a pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes. There is some decent amount of overlap there, because those are also rooted in insulin resistance. There's no overt sign. You can't really diagnose it from blood work. You shouldn't really diagnose it from blood work alone. You kind of do need imaging. So I think those would be some of the reasons why.
Let's stay on diagnosing it. You're saying that this isn't necessarily a thing where I'm having symptoms that are, you know, you should go get that checked out, and then it turns out to be fatty liver. It's more of like a, you know, well, I'll let you answer that. How might somebody find out that mm-hmm. they have fatty liver?
Yeah, well, the technical, like, diagnostic criteria, you need two things. The first is you need actual imaging, right? Again, usually it'll be ultrasound, or what they call a FibroScan, which is a quick 5-minute ultrasound-like imaging that allows us to see and to measure the amount of fat on someone's liver. So you need to have that. And then on top of that, you need to have like one of several other criteria, which almost everyone's going to have one of these. Like, basically any blood work, blood sugar, triglycerides, a low cholesterol, low good cholesterol, high bad cholesterol, a certain weight, a BMI above 25, a certain waist circumference, you need to have one of those, and then the imaging, right? So almost everyone who has the imaging is going to have at least one of those abnormalities as well.
Is the imaging to see like a percent of liver cells with fat, like what is the imaging meant to tell us?
So if you get a FibroScan, it'll actually give you a number called a CAP score, which allows you to estimate ballpark the percentage of your liver that is, let's say they call it infiltrated by fat, which just basically means the amount of cells that are storing fat that shouldn't be. So it depends on the imaging you get. Some type of imaging is much better for actually quantifying, and some imaging is just like, oh, it's there. You know what I mean? Ultrasound is a little bit more general, whereas like an MRI or a FibroScan, you're going to be able to quantify it.
Is this one of those things where everyone's got a little fat in the liver? It's about it reaching a certain threshold, or is this a thing where it's like, hey, any fat in the liver is a red flag for us that it just shouldn't be there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's definitely a threshold condition where usually it gets over 5%, where it becomes problematic. I mean, the reality is like a fatty liver diagnosis early stage, it's not a huge deal, but it does kind of create a fork in the road where if you get this diagnosis, you have a choice, essentially. You can be proactive and make changes, and you can essentially reverse the condition, or you cannot, and your risk of other bad outcomes goes up. Like, you know, your diabetes risk goes up between 2 to 6 times, depending on how much worse it gets over time. You know, your risk of certain cancers, like colorectal cancer, goes up, which is already a very common problematic cancer in the news. You know, cancer for which beans can play a massive role in reducing risk of, right, due to the fiber content. That's why I like it, quite frankly, is that it's early enough that everything's in front of us. And it's also scary enough that I have a captive audience, right? That's really why I'm in it, because we can explore that, but that's a big part of why I'm in this field.
Yeah, yeah. Go, please explore that. I want to circle back around to what happens if you don't treat it, but tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all, you know, in the field of you know, health, nutrition, we develop a philosophy. And like, I've written several books. I've had very much a general private practice, right? Where I see people, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, cholesterol, acid reflux, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you start to develop, you know, overlapping principles, which you notice they tend to resolve most of these issues. Like the same things resolve a lot of these issues, right? So I developed this philosophy, this vision, but then I faced the problem where I need a way to propagate it. And then I have a choice, right? I could do it in the general health umbrella, which is kind of challenging. I can do it in like the weight loss umbrella, which is not my favorite, even though that's an aspect of fatty liver, especially the advanced stage, it's not my favorite thing to focus on. Or I can do it in like basic stuff, like that's already been done. Or I can go on this new frontier where we have fatty liver affects 1 in 3 Americans. It's going to be 4 in 10 in the next 20 years. It affects a large number of people. It's a condition where you have a lot of runway to fix it and to change someone's life. And it gets people kind of compelled to act. So for me, it's a perfect storm. That's how I view it.
And so what happens if I don't treat it? I come in, or if I don't know that I have it, right? Either way, if it progresses, is this a thing where it will directly harm me, or it's a canary in the coal mine of something else that is going to happen to me down the road? What happens?
Yeah, it's both, I would say. So, I mean, people should know that cirrhosis is the end game, like the worst case scenario, but only 3 to 5% of people over a 20-year period go from fatty liver to cirrhosis. So it's far from some sort of guaranteed outcome. You have to be either very unlucky or very belligerent, I guess, for lack of a more diplomatic term, to end up in that position. Okay. But what can happen is that if more liver fat accumulates, it does lead to inflammation and scarring of the liver, which is known as fibrosis. Okay. Fibrosis starts to increase your risk of bad things happening, okay, like liver cancer, cirrhosis, cardiovascular disease, things like that. So you have that phenomenon going on. Then you have the other inevitable phenomenon where if you are doing the kind of things that put you in a position to get fatty liver, I mean, you're also doing the same types of things that increase your risk for type 2 diabetes, which is why, like, big picture, and this will be a good example, there's a study, can't remember the journal now, but wouldn't be too hard to find it, where they looked at people's diabetes risk relative to how their fatty liver progressed or didn't progress. And in the people for whom their fatty liver got worse, their type 2 diabetes risk went up by 6 times. In the people whose fatty liver stayed the same, it doubled. And the people who reversed their fatty liver, they had no additional risk for type 2 diabetes. So that kind of tells you what we're working with, right?
Where does alcohol come into play? Because I think that there's... I don't know. This is why you're on the podcast, that there is a specific issue with alcohol, and like I could develop this with or without alcohol. And so could we talk about how those two distinctions might be made?
Yeah. So this is why they kind of created this new diagnostic criteria. They call it MASLD, which is metabolic associated steatotic liver disease, just to differentiate from causes by alcohol, which you have to have a lot of drinks for you to end up, like, it's much more common. It's just the vast majority of cases are metabolic related. It has to be a lot of alcohol involved. That being said, if you have advanced liver disease, I mean, alcohol really, if your best practice, it needs to be minimized, ideally removed.
Is what's happening similar, but from a different cause? And then my second question is the treatment outside of like just, you know, not drinking, are the same things that would help the person with the metabolic version the same things that would help the person with the alcohol version outside of the don't drink?
I mean, essentially, yes. It just depends. I guess it depends as well what else has manifest in that period, right? Because you have to treat what's manifested, you know, and what are the other issues at hand? Is there, you know, obesity, for example. Now, with fibrosis, which is like the scarring of the liver, it does respond very well to weight loss. That's the reality. Fatty liver, like liver fat, you can make a massive dent in even if your body weight doesn't change that much. So that's like the really differentiating factor. Generally, I would say the principles to resolve both. I mean, obviously, alcohol omission is even more important in the alcohol related case. But I'll be honest, the alcohol related cases are, and obviously when alcohol is involved, there is going to be higher risk of ending up cirrhosis. Okay, like that's also true. So you're in a kind of a different ballpark, right? But I think fundamentally, what you would do with nutrition would not change, unless there are nuanced individual factors, let's say, which could be certain things, but no, it's not super common. Like in realistic in practice, 99% of cases is just metabolic in terms of like what I would see.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you two questions in one, and so I apologize for that. And the first is this just a consequence of having too much overall fat and the body putting some of that in the liver? And is the solution, I guess it's three questions. Is the solution just the same umbrella of things people know they should be doing to get healthy? And are there things outside of that Venn diagram that fall specifically into the category of, no, that this is outside of the general recommendations specifically for the treatment of this?
Yeah. Okay. So those are really good questions. There's a few points there. I think first of all, that it is true that, like, you know, insulin resistance, which is the primary driver, is more likely in individuals who are of a higher body weight, right? So there's no question about that. So that aspect is true. And obviously physical inactivity and certain dietary choices, like higher soft drink consumption, higher alcohol consumption, they do trend in that direction. And there's some nuance, right? There is at least 10% of people have what they call lean fatty liver, which just means their BMI is normal, right? So obviously that means the majority of cases BMI will be like 25 or higher. So there's truth to that as well. And then you get into some more weeds. So for example, antibiotic use is a risk factor for fatty liver disease in people who are otherwise metabolically in good health, right? A history of antibiotic use increases fatty liver risk, I said something like 30%. And that's because of the tie-in with the gut microbiome. Okay, so that's also true. And then when you talk about solutions, well, and then that gets interesting as well, because for example, one of the most, I mean, I'll briefly talk about supplements, like one of the most well-studied supplements for fatty liver, although you can reverse it without this, are probiotics. Okay, and that's to do a lot with the gut-liver connection, right? When we look at the research in terms of if you're looking for something interesting that you would do with fatty liver, maybe you go out of your way to do with fatty liver, I would say probably high polyphenol intake. Okay. Now, polyphenols are just a group of compounds that I would describe them as they have an above average positive influence on the gut environment. Okay. I'll explain a little bit more what that means and what that actually entails. So first of all, polyphenols, I'll list some foods: dark chocolate, cocoa powder, flaxseed, artichoke, blueberries, green tea, coffee, pecans, walnuts. These are not obscure foods. These are foods that we can pretty easily incorporate. Okay. And there was a pretty famous study done where what they found is compared to a Mediterranean diet, a high polyphenol Mediterranean diet, which is just like a Mediterranean diet where they focus a little bit more on foods with more polyphenols, led to way more liver fat reduction. One of the reasons this might be, I mean, above and beyond the fact that like polyphenols like have these antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, pro-insulin sensitivity properties, they're all just generic statements, yes, but they do. They have a positive influence on the gut environment. And why that matters is people with a fatty liver very often have imbalances between like good and bad gut bacteria. Okay. This is observed in like a number of studies. And what that means is when you have too many bad bacteria, quote unquote, they create compounds and they're called LPSs and they get sent to the liver because the blood goes to the digestive system to the liver next. And what these compounds do in small amounts, your liver can handle them. It's no problem. In large amounts, that's when it becomes problematic. And obviously, in someone in quite poor health with a poor diet, sedentary, they're going to have more extreme manifestations, right? So when they're in larger amounts, they essentially overwhelm the liver. They lead to insulin resistance and inflammation within the liver. That then leads to like dysfunctionality and liver fat accumulation. So polyphenols suppress that chain of events for various reasons, one of which is they foster the growth of healthy bacteria. They change the way certain proteins are expressed in the gut. They lower inflammation in the gut, and that leads to that net benefit. So there's a little something there. If I had to offer a bit of a twist to the tail, that's where I would offer it.
Yeah, well, the twist to the tail is interesting to me because I don't want this to be... Well, I don't even know if I want it to be. I want it to be the truth. And the truth might be that the vast majority of the things that you should do are the normal, healthy, nutritious, you know, whatever, exercise, you know, pay attention to some degree to body composition, have muscle exercise, eat fruits and vegetables and fiber and all this stuff, variety diet and all this stuff. And so it's, do you find yourself, okay, so we, I'll use you and I as an example. We might operate with similar tools, but just be working on different buildings where you're like, hey, like I might see somebody who's, you know, has some sort of progression with the fatty liver, but I'm prescribing, so to speak, a very similar set of protocols of a way of improving your diet. And so that question was kind of like, well, what beyond a person that might come to me who feels like they're in general state of less good health than they'd like to, what different prescription might they get from you? And higher polyphenol content might be one of those things.
Sure. 100%. The other thing I would say is, I mean, we all know the value of resistance training, right? Like it's abundantly clear, you know, in every different facet of life, why it's important to pursue. But if you look at strictly, like if you look short to medium term outcomes, and an individual's primary goal is a reduction in liver fat and liver fibrosis, like, right, the best available evidence actually favors aerobic activity for that specific goal. And that can be a minimum of 150 minutes of brisk walking a week. So I'd say don't underestimate walking. Don't underestimate aerobic activity when the short to medium term goal is improvement in your liver scan, improving your liver metrics. So that's another point that, not to say that you don't value that, but if I had to just find something, and you're not wrong. It's true. I mean, general healthy stuff does fix most problems. And can someone be successful in reverse fatty liver disease and never even know what the word polyphenol is? They can, absolutely, right? But it's also true that depending on what stage they're at, the individuals who have this condition and who might come through my door, they're more in the, you know, need all the help they can get category rather than halfway there, need a little boost category. So then these little tips and tricks maybe have higher return on investment for that type of individual. I guess that's also one way to look at it.
I don't want my podcast, I don't want the listener, I don't want our conversation to be entirely weight centric, but I do want to get a picture of weight/weight independent interventions and the efficacy of those things. You know, there'd be people out there who would, you know, we look at diabetes, what, 10 to 20% of people who have developed type 2 diabetes have a normal BMI. And you might say, oh, that's an indication that like this isn't necessarily a body weight thing. And the counter argument would be like, well, those people have maybe a genetic predisposition to store more visceral fat or what have you, that's causing some issues. And ultimately those people should probably lose weight too. That's a hypothesis that's probably out there. And that would point to a very weight-centric view. You know, I don't know how much people use like twin cycle hypothesis discussions and this idea of just, this is just body weight for everyone. This is just excess body fat storage in the places where it should not be. And that weight loss will fix this, you know, either entirely. And that, again, that's not my position. I want to get a picture of the efficacy of like how much can you improve outcomes markers with weight independent interventions versus how powerful is weight loss in comparison?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So let's work backwards from the more severe form, like when you have liver fibrosis, right? And anyone who's been in like the liver clinic, the terms like F1, F2, F3, these are the grades of fibrosis. The higher number, the worse it is. You know, the evidence is super clear that like 10% weight loss massively improves someone's chance of regressing fibrosis. To regress fibrosis is a longer pursuit and a harder pursuit. And arguably it's a more important pursuit because it's more of a harbinger of like bad things happening. It's more of a predictor of bad things happening, right? So it's very clear, right? And this is why it's no coincidence that Health Canada, and I'm from Canada, just approved Wegovy for treatment of advanced fatty liver disease. And the USDA did earlier, and we follow their footsteps. FDA did earlier. It's not a coincidence. It's because they see, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of aspects here, but generally they see the data. It's pretty clear weight loss drastically improves outcomes for advanced fatty liver disease. Now, for basic fatty liver disease, it's a little bit different. Now, look, 5% weight loss will help improve liver markers. Okay, that's fine. And generally, it's going to be because of the behaviors one's going to engage in to get to that 5% weight loss. Fair enough. But what's also true, I'll say what's true and I'll say why it's important to say it. There's a lot of evidence at this stage that physical activity and Mediterranean diet, especially high polyphenol Mediterranean diet, make a massive dent in liver fat independent of any significant weight loss. And that's important, I think, for a subset of people, however big it is to hear, because, you know, I've had many clients who put their best foot forward in all these aspects, and for one reason or another, very likely because they don't have a massive, let's say, calorie budget, they don't have the capability to expend that much energy. They just cannot get the calorie balance right in a prolonged fashion. They just, one reason or another, it just doesn't work for them. But they're doing it, they're doing the right things diet-wise, they're walking a lot. That person can be successful to reverse fatty liver disease and be in good health from that perspective. So I think that's an important message for me to share. So there's two sides to the coin, basically.
For someone who's unfamiliar with a Mediterranean diet eating yep. pattern, could you describe that as if I was a patient in your office who has no idea what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So what the Mediterranean diet is basically saying is the following, is that you probably don't eat much fish, nuts, beans, fruits, or vegetables, or you certainly don't eat as much as you should, okay, of these food groups, whole grains, okay? You probably have an overrepresentation of maybe red meat, poultry, eggs, and dairy. Now, it doesn't mean there's a lot of curation, customization involved, right? To bring this to life. But that in simple terms, it's like you don't eat enough of those foods and you eat too much of these foods. So let's close that gap. That's the simplest way I would put it.
Yeah. Yeah. What foods on that list do you find most people are eating dramatically not enough of? Maybe all of those.
I mean, fish has to be up there. Nuts has to be up there. Beans, probably chief among them. Yeah, I would say, I mean, the thing is it's also about an appreciation of the importance of a food, right? Because people generally, they know fruits and vegetables. I mean, this day and age, I know everything's muddied, fair enough. But, you know, the people in front of me, they know fruits and vegetables are important. And maybe they oscillate in terms of how much they pursue them. But a lot of people don't really realize things like nuts and beans, how much of a difference it is to pursue those assertively. Versus to disregard them, because you can have on paper what looks like a strong diet and not have those foods. But we know, I mean, those foods offer something pretty unique that's not easy to replicate elsewhere. Now, I'm kind of contradicting what I said earlier, where if your diet's really strong, you can get away without those foods. But I'm talking about someone who's a little bit vulnerable here. I'm not talking about someone who's done it all right for 20 years. I'm talking about someone who's just getting going, trying to do the right things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's talk through just, I want to move on to nutrition strategies, exercise strategies. I want to talk about some beans. Lab markers. How's somebody actually going to know? I know we touched on it briefly, but more prescriptively. Yep. How's someone going to know that this is a problem? How's their doctor going to know? How are they going to find out? People are mm-hmm. going to say, oh, I got my liver enzymes checked. Is that enough? People have seen liver enzymes, ALT, AST. Mm-hmm. Is that enough to know? Is that enough to get a picture of what's going on? Maybe you're someone who doesn't have a PCP and you're doing lab through a third party company. And is there a way for you to find out this information? What should you look for?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, liver enzymes are always going to be of interest. However, they're not really a great predictor of what's going on in your liver, especially once you make changes. So you don't want to use your liver enzymes as the only thing you're going to look at to indicate success. Very often they will lower after other good things have already happened. So the worst case scenario is you think that you're making all these changes, you only look at your liver enzymes, they don't change, and you think that you're doing the wrong things. That's the worst case scenario, I guess, that I wouldn't want anyone to be in. So you have to be very careful. There are equations that are more for people with advanced fatty liver disease. Like, I would say the more complicated your health is, the more relevant liver enzymes are. I think that's fair to say. But earlier stage fatty liver, let's just say you can't get a fibro scan, which I think this technology is going to be increasingly available and not that expensive. So I think more and more people will be able to get these scans. They're 5 minutes. They might cost, depending on insurance or otherwise, it might cost $100 out of pocket.
Can I pause you while we're talking about the scan? So,
yeah.
So if I think of a correlate, something like a calcium score, you know, things that I might do routinely, even if I have downstream markers that look okay, like I might still be interested in a calcium score. If my whole life my cholesterol has been okay, I'd be less interested in it, but I'd still be like, it's maybe something I should do at some point. Is this a similar thing, or is this once you see this, maybe it's time to go do that?
Yeah, if you have strong reason to believe that you have a fatty liver and you are a metrics-driven person, it's basically like getting a DEXA scan before you go on a 6-month bulk or cut. and you care about your body. Let's put it that way. That's the easiest, if I had to translate it to maybe the fitness oriented world, right? Because it's going to tell you how much fat essentially is in your liver, and then you're going to be able to compare it to the next scan 6 months later. So it's pretty sweet now, but also, of course, not everyone can get one. So what do we do if we can't? If I'm saying that liver enzymes are not sufficient and you can't get a fibro scan, what I would look at next are triglycerides, HDL cholesterol, like good cholesterol, fasting glucose, fasting insulin, if you get that. Are those getting better? If all of those are going in the right direction, my confidence that your liver health is getting better is going up, because what we know is that the things that get those to be out of range are the same things that physiologically lead your liver to store fat. So I would say those blood work would be really indicative.
I'm imagining a person getting blood work back and liver enzymes are high. Like, at what point would you suggest this scan?
A fibro scan, I would suggest, given that we're talking about, you know, if economically it's viable and someone is very confident they have a fatty liver and they're going to go make a bunch of changes, right? I would say if it's available to you, I would just get it as soon as possible. And then at least you have a comparator, right? Now, realistically, what yields the positive changes is not getting the scan. It's all the behaviors. So if getting two is not in the picture, go do the right things. You know, or find someone who's going to teach you the right things and get a scan later, right? Or, you know, it's like you can never get a scan, and if your blood work is really good, you're going to be okay. You know what I mean? That's also true, right? With very minor exceptions, there's always sometimes little things that kind of can sneak in, and there's genetic factors. So I want to be a little bit careful saying that, but generally speaking, you know, if your body weight came down, all your blood work got better, you're doing the things that professionals have told you to do, realistically, your liver fat levels are going down.
If someone is diagnosed with fatty liver tomorrow, you know, we do a scan, we say, okay, we see what we need to see. What nutrition changes most directly reduce liver fat? And I know we talked briefly about just dietary pattern. What I want to ask you, what is the laundry list, right? What's the laundry list? What's the, you know, I'm testing you and I want to hear every single thing you know. But then what are you telling a patient in the moment? And what are you telling them insofar as, like, with an intent to treat, right? Like with an actual, how can I get this person to make some big ROI changes? What are those? What's the difference between the laundry list of things that can help and how you might handle that conversation with someone who, you know, just anybody, all of us in general, like to see that laundry list, that might not be helpful. What are you doing instead? How's that conversation going?
Yeah, well, some of that depends on if they have other factors at play, right? Like blood sugar, other things and so on. But generally, first point is, you know, let's make sure that we're getting enough protein for a variety of reasons. First of all, protein at a meal reduces post-meal blood sugar response. Fatty liver and diabetes are tied together. As soon as you have a fatty liver, you don't have to obsess about blood sugar regulation, but you should care a little more than the average person. So obviously adequate protein spread out at every meal. Yes, protein obviously increases satiation. You know, being satiated after meals, everybody wants that. Lower blood sugar, more satiation. Like that's the outcome that we all, you know, essentially desire, especially when we're compromised. But beyond that, we want diversity in protein because the evidence is very clear, right? Saturated fat, and this is actually the cool thing about working in liver health is that, you know, sometimes people like to muddy the water of saturated fat for other outcomes, even though, you know, it is what it is. But with liver fat specifically, it's pretty clear. Saturated fat really does increase liver fat storage. Like there's a lot of controlled trials as compared to like monounsaturated fat, like basically nuts and olives versus cheese and butter.
Are these in overfeeding studies where they overfeed people?
Yes, there's one very famous overfeeding study. Yeah, where they did that, but the outcome was drastically different, right? It was the liver fat change. We're talking about plus 55% of the saturated fat, plus 15% in the monounsaturated fat, and then additional insulin resistance as well in the saturated fat study. So, but it's the bigger picture is anyway. So diversity in protein intake, sufficient protein intake, yes, and then from there. In simplest terms, I'm looking for them to check to have at least one food from each of these four groups represented daily, right? This is more in the Mediterranean vein of the Mediterranean style diet. You know, at least one fruit, at least one vegetable. If we can pick a high polyphenol choice, great. At least one type of quote unquote healthy fat, which could be a nut, could be an avocado, get that monounsaturated fat. And ideally, at least one type of legume per day. Because if they check those four boxes, you know, my confidence that they're going to have like a low to moderate, they're going to have like a low to moderate glycemic effect on the diet. They're going to have enough fiber. They're going to have enough compounds that affect their gut bacteria. they're going to be more satiated, goes up. But that's bare bones, right? Because we could really go into this. But if I had to give a bare bones, sufficient protein, diversity in protein, at least one fruit from each of those groups, okay. And then we can evolve it from there.
Is that a conversation you have quite often? It's like, hey, let's try and check those boxes. Is that figurative or is that something you're actually telling people?
So I'm telling people this, but I'm telling them, if I have someone in front of me where I'm going to curate a day in their life, I'm telling this to them as we progress the conversation. So I'm going to tell them to do certain things. And then I'm going to tell them why, what I'm trying to achieve in telling them those things. So I may or may not start with that point, but I have that point in mind.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But they will know that that's what I want for them.
Right.
Essentially.
Right. If you could pick just one, if you could say, well, we're going to try and do just one thing, what would that one thing be?
Like one swap, like one thematic change.
It could be. I appreciate the distinction there. If you feel like there's a thematic change that would feel powerful, or if it's a single food swap that you think would be powerful as a single food swap, I'm open to both of those. You can do one of each.
Yeah, I would say, let's say, you know, red meat for fish. Okay. I think that's a swap that is within people's grasps, and that's a double whammy because you increase your exposure to omega-3 and you decrease your exposure to saturated fat. So that's like, you know, that's a big one. And then I would say, I mean, I could give you two other ones. I could either say, well, let's say white rice is very commonly consumed grain. So I would say not swap, combine white rice 50-50 with beans going forward.
Love
or
that.
Generally reduce the glycemic influence of your meals. And there's many different ways we can do that, including manipulating food order, the speed at which we eat, the nature of the carbohydrates, right? There's a lot of things we could do. So those would be two things, I guess I would say.
Is that reduction in glycemic excursion, let's say, is that in pursuit of maybe a more stable satiety response, or is there a unique independent impact happening here for liver fat?
Well, I mean, it depends where someone is on the gradient, right? Because, you know, fatty liver and pre and type 2 diabetes are heavily tied together. Okay. Like, you know, and it's like, who are we talking about? Are we talking about that individual that's going to do everything right going forward? Are we just talking about a person who's like putting an honest effort in and they just need to win as much as they can? Right. Because if it's the latter, then yeah, there means they're going to have many meals in their life where that optimal glycemic response is not going to be forthcoming. So let's make sure it is when we have the ability to do so. So that's more so my mindset around that.
That's awesome. Let's talk exercise. What role does exercise play? How much can exercise or improving fitness alone, independent of weight loss, improve liver fat? And then we could have that kind of a bit of the rehashing the lifting versus cardio discussion.
Yeah. So minimum, like what we call like the minimum effective dose for to have like a chance, a very, very good chance to reduce your liver fat by a clinically meaningful amount, is to walk 150 minutes per week briskly or beyond. So basically moderate intensity cardiovascular activity, brisk walking is probably like the bare minimum threshold for that, right? So it's that 150 minute a week number. I mean, there's going to be more benefits if you go a little bit higher up. And then when you look more closely at the evidence, it does look like a lot of the benefit from that activity is independent of weight loss. Some of it is weight loss, is influenced by weight loss, but the majority of that benefit doesn't come from weight loss. And in fact, in some studies, the entirety of the benefit is not tied in with weight loss.
What is the mechanism by which an improvement in fitness improves metabolic health, or in this context, fatty liver, independent of weight loss?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, it's going to improve insulin sensitivity. And I mean, insulin resistance is tied in with fatty liver disease. It changes gene expression. I think it's the PPARY gene, and there's another gene which I can't. I'm trying to move like, you know, I'm the one who's been guilty of like going way too deep into the weeds past the point of relevance for people. So I've tried to move away from that last few months. But there are genes that are activated uniquely by both resistance and cardiovascular training that influence how fat is stored at, let's say, a cellular level, right? So there's gene activation. There's, I think, insulin sensitivity response. Same reason why you take a walk after a meal, you know, your blood sugar is going to be lower because your cells are taking up more sugar independent of really expending that many calories at all. Yeah. So I guess that would be the easy answer.
Yeah. Again, you're in a different world, but I've often been fascinated at how an improvement in fitness can independently decrease visceral fat. It's like you didn't lose weight, but you have less visceral fat. That visceral fat has, you know, moved somewhere else. And so there is a weight independent benefit of exercise that is really important. I think I think it's super important for people to hear. You know, I just think that we're, I'm not saying get the fitness side is just easier. I wouldn't make a blanket statement like that, but it's, people need to know that it's not just about weight loss. And I say it, I just mean overall metabolic health, and that they you're not exercising specifically for the goal of weight loss, like you had mentioned, that there's absolutely independent benefits there. And so that's good to hear. Let's talk a little bit about the magnitude of change that we can see, and then we'll have that a bit of that lifting versus cardio chat.
Yeah. So when we talk about like a clinically relevant response, they, what they call that is a 30% reduction in liver fat levels, right? So imagine if someone had, just to, we'll make it up, and they have 100 grams of liver fat, 30% is 30 grams. Okay. So that's what they call clinically relevant response. So people who walk 150 minutes a week or more, or do moderate cardio, have three and a half higher odds of achieving that. So those are very good odds. Okay. Equally, so I said earlier, I was talking about the high polyphenol Mediterranean diet. What they found in that study is with 39% reduction in liver fat levels. So you can see when you do both of those things, and there's another study done where they did diet and exercise, and the magnitude of change. And I think the exercise was a bit more than just walking. It was a bit more robust, a little bit longer. But it was equal magnitude of change. I think it was something like 40% each. So there's different studies, right? The problem is, a part of the problem is the evidence. We have a lot of evidence in this area, but we don't have as much as we do for like type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes. It's still a little bit, you know, it's a little bit more novel. There's not that diversity of studies where I can pull from these comprehensive meta-analysis and have all these really firm claims, but sometimes I can. So that's what you're looking at, really. And, you know, that's what it is.
Is there, again, like you said, my question will probably be met with your previous answer there of like, I would be interested in, yeah, I guess if you're saying that study does exist, where you're like, hey, that was exercise versus nutrition. That wasn't necessarily lifting versus cardio. You know, interestingly, these discussions of like, should I lift or should I do cardio? Like there's a short-term answer, like, hey, one of those might be in the short term more specific to the task at hand, but like as a long-term lifelong goal, we should probably be doing both of those. So it's a bit of a moot point. I think if you're like, hey, I only have time for one, or I have a preference towards this, like maybe the cardiovascular side, the aerobic exercise maybe has, again, in the short term, short to medium to long term, right? Or even forever, you know, has a more specific benefit. But ultimately, we're met with kind of like, but for life, you know, for all the goals that you have outside of just reducing liver fat, like we should probably do both of these things.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to find any disagreement from me on that. I think there's the other kind of elephant in the room, whatever you want to call it, that if you have an individual in front of you, they have no history of exercise and they're just kind of scared. They just got fatty liver and like, they just want to make positive changes. You know, what's more likely, that they're going to walk 150 minutes a week, or they're going to be hitting the gym and doing, you know, 8 different machines on a circuit, you know? I'm an idealist. I'm an optimist, and I want the best people I work with. But sometimes there's some realities, and we have to work with where we're at and grow from there.
There's a familiarity with walking and incline walking, or even just cardio in general. There's a greater familiarity, and so yes, I'm with you in the idealism and the optimism. But I also want what's best for people, and sometimes that is meeting them where they're at, or often will be.
And I'll say this: there was a study done where they had it was like very simple body weight training. Okay. 30 minutes a week, 3 times a week. This is what I'll show clients this study who I know are like very novice in this area. Body weight squats, and they had a whole diagram for it. It was a very specific modified version, and then knee push-ups. And that was enough to lower liver fat a certain amount. It wasn't going to be that big number, but it was enough to lower a certain amount. So that is, if I have someone who's inclined to resistance training, but really at the bare entry point, I often show them the diagrams of that study and say, hey, listen, here you go. Here's a starting point. Let's see where this takes you.
That's awesome. Is there anything on liver fat that you felt, you know, you came here today that you'd like to say that we didn't cover that you think is important?
I feel pretty good about what we covered. You know, I mean, there's always minutia, but in terms of like actually actionable guidance, I think we cover what I would like to cover.
Great. Which we can finally move on to what's really important, which is farting and beans. No, is our ode to legumes. And this is originally how I found you, just some really great bean-related content. Could you wax lyrical for me a bit about your love for legumes?
Yeah, I just think, like, again, 10 years into this game, looking at all the studies, talking to all these people, like, you know, what do people want to feel after a meal? Again, they want to feel more satiated, okay? They want to have a lower blood sugar. Like, I'm not universally, right? But I'm oversimplifying. They want people I work with, they want to feel more satiated. They want a lower blood sugar response. They want something that's economical, okay? check, 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 right? And then bigger picture, they want, they don't know this, but what they also want is they want a more like, you know, robust and diverse gut microbiota. They want to have, I mean, they definitely want lower cholesterol. They definitely want lower cardiovascular disease risk. They want lower colorectal cancer risk. And it's just, hey, beans, just check every single box possible. And they're so potent that even if you have an individual who, let's say, loves white rice, and I've met, you know, many people fall in this category, you combine white rice 50-50 with beans, and then you get, you know, you mitigate the quote unquote negative of white rice, which is the high glycemic response and probably the lack of micro and anything really overly unique. And then you still get a food you like, and then metabolically, you're still winning, right? So that's a little snapshot, but just their potential to do so many things that like the quote unquote average person needs is so high. And it's just, it's impossible for me to look away from that. And it's, and they're just underconsumed, right? Like people just, like they're not really widely consumed. I mean, they're certainly consumed in areas of the world people live the longest, which is just, I know it's, we can't draw massive conclusions about that, but that's fascinating, right? Oh, hey, there's all these areas in the world people live long, they eat beans. Well, you know, it makes sense because what, you know, they do protect you from what could kill you, you know? You know, they play a role, that's for sure. So
why are they underconsumed?
I think that, well, look, you're talking to someone who probably didn't touch beans for the first like 20, 25 years of his life, right? So I guess I'd be a good case study. People, either they don't appreciate their benefits. That's obviously a big one, right? Lack of appreciation for their benefits, lack of understanding of how to prepare them, lack of introduction culturally, familially, a misunderstanding about their influence on gut health and how they cause flatulation and how, you know, and what can be done to relatively easily to mitigate that, right? All of those, I think, are, you know, I don't need a study to tell you that those are the reasons. And I mean, there are studies that tell you those are the reasons, but I don't, you know.
Yeah, I think you hit on one that I think people don't talk about enough, which I think there is a misconception about the sensation of bloating or farting as like, oh, mm-hmm. that's bad for me. I have a bacterial overgrowth and my gut can't handle this. And by the way, you and I will both say, hey, if you're increasing your fiber intake, there's something to doing that gradually and drinking enough water and make sure you move. And there is totally absolutely discomfort that can happen that we can mitigate a bit. And I'm with that. But this idea of like, yeah, oh, I ate this food, I got a little bloated or I had gas afterwards means it's bad. It's just not true. I mean, there could be scenarios where that points to something. But this idea that is that, those are both things that if I could give you everything in the world, fine. I don't want you to get overly bloated after a meal or have a ton of unwanted gas. I don't want those two. Right. But I've had people message me after like some, I'll make a bean related content, like, hey, you know, like, what do you do about the farting? I'm like, nothing. I'm like, I fart, you know, and like, you know, and that doesn't mean that there's something bad for me. I know that the beans are just incredibly right good for me, and you deal with that. Do you encounter that discussion ever?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And then there's the mitigating strategies are the quantity, right? Starting a certain amount, maybe staying a certain amount, depending on the individual, the foods you combine them with, the types of bean you choose, like you know, canned lentils have the lowest potential of any bean to cause gas. And that's a lot to do with like their FODMAP content, which are just these components of foods which could cause these digestive issues in some people, particularly people with IBS, right? So there's like a laundry list of things you could do to reduce it. And also if you know you get a certain level of response to them, which I feel very confident for a lot of people, we can manipulate, okay? So that, let me say that first. But let's just say it's a guarantee you get a bit of a response, then you can just be strategic when you have them as well. Like, what's the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
Right?
Can you speak a bit to canned versus fresh, different preparations of them? Does this matter at all for health or gut health? Does it matter for enjoyment?
So canned lentils and canned chickpeas, I believe, generally end up being, because of the, they are already prepared, right? They're cooked, they're soaked, et cetera. So you rinse them and they're ready to go. So they have a lower potential to cause gut issues. It also, you know, extremely convenient and so on. So I would say, you know, for someone who has concerns around the gas causing potential, canned lentils would be your go-to. And maybe keep it to a quarter cup, a third cup, which by the way is, you know, perfect rule, we get a little bit higher than that ultimately, but that's enough to tap into their benefits.
Overall, is there a nutritional thing to consider when we're talking about canned versus not canned?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, you're going to have, you know, there's going to be some people who just don't like philosophically the idea of canned food, right? So, you know, you can get, if you're really concerned, get them in a carton, you know, cook them from dry, get a BPA free can if that really concerns you. But at the end of the day, we talk about, like, you know, long-term health, like what's really causing people actual problems with cholesterol and blood sugar and colorectal cancer. You know, it's, you know, it's a lack of fiber. It's, it, you know, it's a lack of gut microbiome health. It's a lack of, like, magnesium and you know, excessive blood sugar response with beans can help with. So we always have to make a cost benefit analysis around stuff on some level, right? So I feel like with beans, canned beans, the benefit far outweighs the cost. And I mean, that's how I'd frame it.
And
but to each their own. I mean, if, you know, if someone has, I don't think it's worthy having big concerns in this area, but if someone does, I respect that. Okay. There's always plan A, B, C, D.
Totally. And I appreciate that caveat there. I'm on my bean journey and can't imagine. Like, I have a young daughter. We're about to have a second child. The idea of, like, again, I know that this is like a joke. It's a joke that I'm about to say this, but I can't imagine, like, soaking them overnight. I'm like, I can't imagine not having them in a can. And I've had that same chat with me where I'm like,
in the same boat.
I'm like, let me go down this road of, like, finding out if there's anything, any different issues. Maybe it's just the sodium content, whatever. And I'm like, okay, like, at the end of the day, like, the canned are fine. I can't come up with a real reason why they are not fine or that there is really any downside to speak of. And it's easier. It's just easier to prepare. It's just become a no-brainer. I'm like, hey, you're not soaking, prepping. And there's going to be people out there. So I always do that where I'm like, hey, this thing I'm thinking about. Tofu. Tofu is a great example. I went on social media. And I was like, somebody help me like tofu. And I had a million people like, oh, I have this super easy recipe. And they're like, step one, take the tofu, put it in a book, put something heavy on top of it, flatten it. I'm like, no. I'm like, you lost me. And so, you know, I just from a lazy perspective. But yeah, canned beans, lentils. I mean, honestly, man, like, not to get too crazy, but like, people talk about ultra processed foods and that as a classification that automatically makes everything bad. But like, we have some just like amazing products out there that are just like,
100%.
We have totally, our food environment is fucked and it's incredibly challenging. It's way more challenging to eat more nutritiously, but we have some amazing products. I got the edamame bean snack the other day.
I tell my clients that I consider that to be probably the best snack on the market. And broadly speaking, in terms of a snack, like that afternoon snack slot where you want to be satiated, boost your fiber and protein content, eat a food that you may not be eating elsewhere in the day. The amount is pre-controlled in the sense that, like, okay, you're not going to eat to the point of having gas. I see nothing better. And in terms of gap filling, in terms of what people are missing, I consider that family of products roasted edamame to be the most best afternoon snack that exists. That's totally, my honest opinion.
Totally. And there's and the bean pasta realm is booming. And we have some high That's quality fair. Products yeah. that actually aren't terrible in terms of texture. They're pretty solid. Even little things. One of the things that I would recommend people do is, like, if you have ground meat, just go 50-50. I've been going, if I'm having ground meat for my family, I'm like, cool, we're going 50-50 lentils, you know, like it's just,
sure.
Gram for gram, like if I would have had 150 grams of meat, I am able to cut my meat consumption down by 50% and get lentils in there and not really sacrifice anything. And like you said, that it's not just the addition of lentils. It's, hey, I'm having maybe less saturated fat from red meat and I'm having more plant protein and fiber. And so doing that 50-50, what are some other ways that you mentioned 50-50 with white rice? Are there any other ones that, you know, microwaved edamame, you know, Costco makes just like a really nice pre-portioned bag of edamame that's just like it's not like I have to make a million of them. It's just like this nice pre-portioned pack. It's enough for like one or two people that I find just incredibly easy to implement. What are some other ways that you found to implement more beans and legumes?
Yeah, well, I mean, going off of your edamame idea, that's really smart, especially for someone who's trying to get a little bit of a bonus in the blood sugar area. You start the meal with like half a thing of edamame. First of all, I mean, you're going to front load fiber and protein, so it's going to reduce the overall effect of the meal on your blood sugar levels. You're going to knock off a bunch of protein, so maybe you can save money or rely less on animal protein if you're someone who's just trying to get into that ball game, right? So that is actually really, really smart. Yeah, I look at legumes basically, and the way that you're talking about to mix with ground beef is actually very, very intelligent. There's no wrong way to do it. I look at legumes as like the pinnacle of starchy foods, which is like everything we want from like a starch, fiber, minimal blood sugar effect, high micronutrient content, unique effect on our blood work. Legumes have that more really than anything else. So it's natural to me that we might mix them with other starchy foods like, you know, quinoa or barley or buckwheat or sweet potato or rice or whatever the case may be. That's how I envision them and how I kind of like propagate the message. But I just say, like, look, you take a can of beans, drain them, rinse them, throw them on the frying pan with some seasoning, and then you do, you know, what you're going to do with them. They can obviously be put into, like, into bowl-type dishes, burrito-type dishes. And on tofu, by the way, I'm going to give you my path of least resistance advice. Take the brick, maybe make four rectangles, season the heck out of both sides, and put it in the air fryer for 30 minutes at, like, 400. I think that's the path of least resistance. It's cooking. It's better if you pan fry it. That's very labor-intensive. So I don't do that. But that would be my path of least resistance for tofu for anyone listening and for you.
Cool. No, I appreciate that. It's still something that I'd like to do. So absolutely still on board. What's some of your favorite bean-related research? Hold on. P.S. Before you answer that, I want to be sensitive to your time. We're up over an hour.
I'm okay.
Okay. Yeah. Probably 10 minutes max.
No sweat. Cool. No sweat.
Let it rip. Bean-related research.
Yeah. So, okay. So let me start by saying the following. Beans are one of the things that beans suffer from is they're a little bit harder to study than nuts, because, for example, and nuts we have like very good research, okay, quarter cup a day, 20% lower risk of like all cause mortality, 20% lower risk of cardiovascular disease. It's pretty great.
That's wild, by the way.
Beans, yeah. I mean, nuts for me are, yeah, I mean, well worth it. High polyphenol, high and unique types of fats that aren't found that many other foods, fiber, etc. In some, like, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I think what beans suffer from a bit is like they're always in like mixed dishes with other stuff. Right, people don't necessarily eat beans in huge amounts for obvious reasons in one sitting, and they're mixed in with stuff. So I think beans suffer a little bit from that. Okay, now there's something called the Be Gone trial. It's a cool study to look at. They gave people a cup of canned beans per day, I think it was, and just really remarkable effects on inflammatory markers, remarkable effects on the gut, like a specific family of gut bacteria where. It's called Fekeli bacterium, okay? Prosnitzi, it's a specific type of bacteria. And everywhere we look, people who are healthier, they have higher levels of less bacteria, and people who are less healthy have lower levels. Doesn't mean that the cause and effect is there, but it's certainly fascinating. So we see like beans feed this specific type of bacteria, really, really interesting. And then you just look at other trials where people, you know, mix rice and beans together, significantly lower blood sugar response, lower insulin resistance markers. I think I just shared a study where essentially, the other day I was talking about social media. I'm oversimplified, but essentially what it was is they compare either two people like living their life, two cups of white rice a day versus one cup of white rice and one cup of lentils, and just like really significant reductions in insulin resistance after 8 weeks of doing that, right? And then some of the benefits, which is just to feel more full and to have a lower blood sugar response after a meal, which again, like if you think about, I'm not making a real parallel here, but if you think about like GLP-1 medication, I mean, what does it do? It lowers your blood sugar, it makes you more full. Like that, you know, that's a valuable outcome. I mean, it's oversimplification, but beans do that too when you swap them with other carbohydrates or you use them as the main carbohydrate, right? So there's a lot of studies in that area, but I do think beans also suffer a little bit, in broad studies trying to link their intake because they always mix with other stuff. It's hard to separate. Someone smarter than me might have a better answer to that, but I think there's something to that.
No, I think, and you know what? You said that study was like, hey, we did a cup of, I think it was a cup of beans. Those always strike me as powerful, very implementable things. And now that's not a recommendation that scales to the individual. Like it's not fair for me adding a cup of beans and a 125 pound person adding a cup of beans on half the calories. It's a different ball game, but I will say that those fall short there. It's like saying, you know, everyone should eat 150 grams of protein. Like that doesn't help, but
for sure.
But I find those even like your what you had said earlier of like, hey, we're going to try and eat a food from each of these categories each day. Those sorts of food focused, not necessarily nutrient focused. I think when we talk too much about saturated fat and added sugar and this and that, I think if you're educated in the space a bit, you can translate that into foods. I think what helps people the most is specific types of food to implement. Like you said, the research on nuts is unequivocal. This, you know, it's like, hey, we can, you know, if you look at something like the portfolio diet to like lower ApoB, it's like very specific. It's like, hey, 40 grams of nuts per day. You know, those sorts of things where we cut through, it's like, eat less saturated fat, eat more fiber. People are like, cool, like me and you can translate that to food and our listeners probably can, but not public at large. And so those sorts of things, like, can we get you to have, you know, it's like, crack open a can of beans early in the day, rinse it, and they sit on the counter until they're gone. Like, of course, I'm kind of joking, but like those sorts of things that have a big ROI where it's like, can we get, you know, an ounce of nuts per day and a cup of beans per day somewhere in your day every day? Though, again, every time you make a rule, you have to caveat of like, oh, it's the point is you can be flexible with it and fine. But these sorts of specific food related recommendations or a food in this category, food in that category, I find those to be very powerful. And so I saw that study that you put up of a cup of beans. And I was like, that,
yep.
We don't need to talk about that. You know, that's go put a, eat a cup of beans per day, change your life. You know, like that sort right. of a thing instead of like, eat, swap this out and eat more of this. And those are great. But that felt to me like a very powerful everyone could implement that tomorrow and not complicated sort of thing. So I really do appreciate that part of that study for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, awesome, 100%. And yeah, to your point, right? It's the reason why I like that kind of food group separation in the way that you kind of mentioned, I talked about earlier is like, let's say you want somebody 20 grams more of fiber. Let's just make up the number. Well, you can tell them that and then say a bunch of other stuff. But if someone eats one food from each of those groups daily, the chance that they're going to get 20 grams of fiber is very high. And they're going to get a bunch of other stuff too, for example, right? So that's why I like that. Yeah. And it also creates a perpetual but easy to conquer checklist in people's heads around their food intake for the day. So that's, I've grown to really, and also simplicity, to your point, simplicity is key. So that's how I arrived at that. It's not like it's a flawless a criteria, but that's what I've kind of landed on as part of my approach, at the very least.
Maybe 6-7 years ago in my working with clients, I began getting really big on counting your fiber, or just like paying attention to fiber, whether it's counting it or whatever, some sort of monitoring around fiber. And counting fiber and fiber gram related daily recommendations became something I was like, hey, this is like way more, this is as important as any macronutrient and calorie intake. This is super important. However, recently, maybe in the last like 3 to 5 years, we have a boom of foods that have added isolated fibers to them. And those foods are fine. I'm not saying those foods are bad. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But it has changed the fiber gram recommendations. Because what it used to be was, hey, I want you to get to 25 grams of fiber. Because that's a really good proxy for fruit and vegetable and legume and nut and seed intake. It's turned into not that lately, where like in the last couple of years, I'm like,
fair point.
I'm like, yeah, we're at 51 grams of fiber. Like, can you talk me through that? And they're like, well, I had 3 mission wraps and a bagel, this bagel that has 30, you know, we have bagels that have 30 grams of fiber in them. So I do, I have been switching a little bit of the way I've been talking to clients about this of like, well, fiber targets, great, but that's not enough for me. I don't want us both just looking at a column and being proud of that. I also want us focusing on diversity and check these boxes, fill these buckets. And so I think that was a point that you echoed with your patients of like, hey, we might not, you're doing it, which is you're like, hey, I'm not telling them 20 grams of fiber. I'm telling them, let's get a fruit, let's get a vegetable, let's get a legume. And so I think you're doing a really great job of that. And I think that circumvents, again, I don't think those foods are inherently bad. They are bad insofar as they displace these other foods in the pursuit of a certain daily recommendation of fiber.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, that comes down to the individual, right? I mean, my job is to make sure that they get done what they need to get done, and everyone's different, you know, but that is a very fair point. And that's clearly the case. You're right. People can game the system a little bit, and that's better than no fiber, but certainly in my view, it's not better than getting it from a diversity of whole food groups that have an abundance of other benefits. But nutrition is a game of teach their own, and everyone's in a different place. So there's different solutions for different people at different times, and, you know, fair enough.
I appreciate that. Dude, you're wonderful. Great having you on. Appreciate you being here. We'll have to kick a ball around sometime if I flee the country and come up north. Thanks, Andy.
Catch you soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.